This episode of the Exchange Podcast is brought to you by Confederation Group, your experts in immigration and recruitment services.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of the Exchange Podcast, where we talk to people from across PEI, people with connection to PEI, and people looking to help advance PEI. And I'm really delighted today to be with Kate McKenna. And Kate is a former Charlottetown resident. She's been with CBC as a journalist since, over 13 years, and presently living in Ottawa. And really delighted to have you here. You've got some specializations within your journalistic focus, and we can chat about those as well. But why don't you give us a little bit of an introduction of yourself, and we'll kind of go into how you left PEI and what you're doing in Ottawa today.
Sure. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me on your podcast. So I grew up on PEI. I grew up in Charlottetown. Both of my parents lived there. Both of my families are from PEI, like on both sides of my family, and they have been for generations. So I have a very close connection to the island, and I miss it very much. And I just went kind of the classic route, like Spring Park, Queen Charlotte, Colonel Gray, UPEI, and then after that I decided I wanted to get into journalism. I briefly worked in the private sector in PEI. I worked for Tim Banks. I was his personal assistant for a little bit.
Very good. Okay.
And then I went to journalism school. And then I always knew, CBC has such a large presence on PEI. So I always knew I wanted to work for the CBC. And so I was very lucky to get a series of internships after that that kind of took me all over the place. Like, I started my career in the Arctic. I started it in the Iqaluit. And then I came back and lived in Montreal for most of the last 15 years, I guess, about 8-9 years in Montreal. And then I moved to Ottawa 3 years ago to take a new job on Parliament Hill, which I love. It's like my dream job. I've been interested in politics since I was a kid. So it's fabulous.
Well, we have sent an invitation out to Tim Banks. I'd love to get his perspective on many things on PEI, and he's got lots to share. So we'll see if he accepts that invitation now that you've been on the podcast. And you were a reporter for CBC Charlottetown for a short time. Did you go to Holland College? Was that your path? Is it a traditional path through journalism?
But they have a great program. Like, a lot of people who come out from that program are fabulous. But no, I went to King's. I did their 1 year program. And that was also awesome. I mean, those are really kind of the two, unless you're choosing to go to Ontario or somewhere further, those are kind of your two options if you want to be a journalist. A lot of people don't even, I shouldn't say a lot of people, many people who go on to become professional journalists don't even have degrees in journalism. Like, it's really kind of something that you learn as you do it. But I had a great experience at King's, and King's kind of gave me the access to the internships. I ended up getting, in the CBC world, it's called the Donaldson Scholarship, which is like it's not a fast track, but it is like a way into the system. In that space considered like a bit of a help, to get established within the CBC. So I did that early on, and then was able to kind of keep building on my skills and building on my experiences to, eventually kind of work up, not that I'm very high up, but, up to the job that I have now, which is great.
So you're a senior parliamentary reporter with CBC, and I look at you and I don't think that you're that senior person, at least compared to me, you don't seem that senior. How did you go from reporting in Charlottetown to becoming a senior parliamentary reporter, which is a pretty big deal and a great accomplishment for someone from, the smallest legislature in Canada to the center of government influence?
Well, actually, Blake, I have said this to other people, and I fully believe that one of the best things you can do if you're a journalist is come to PEI, because it's not like, you wake up in the morning and some other places, like I worked in Montreal, there are a series of events you kind of have to cover. Like, oh, there's a conference at City Hall, or oh, there's some big report coming out or something like that. And there are things like that on PEI, obviously, but at a much lesser frequency. And so you have to be reading the documents. You have to be looking for stuff, talking to people, kind of figuring out kind of what constitutes a story, like somebody doing something for a reason, like does it meet the bar for news? And the CBC and the Guardian, It's still called The Guardian, right?
It is still called, and it's gone through a couple of transitions, different ownerships, but it's probably one of the most successful newsprints, certainly in Atlantic Canada, and it's kind of the flagship of the current ownership group. But journalism's difficult, and from observation, there's so much pressure on journalists to report quickly. Like, and our attention span is like 140 characters. So I've got colleagues of mine and friends, I guess, at The Guardian and salt print media, but even in radio media and visual television media, is there a lot more pressure today to, you know, I'm sure with CBC, you've got to do all the fact checking you've always been accustomed to, but is there greater pressures on journalism now than there was at any point in the past? There's a lot of social journalism. There's a lot of misinformation. How do you adapt to that reality?
It's a good question. I always tell people it's sort of like, imagine every day you work, and then people check your work en masse, sometimes to the tune of a million people, you know, so if you make a mistake, it's a very public mistake to make.
And even if you don't make a mistake, everybody's got an opinion on what you're saying.
That's it. Most, you know, most people are, polite. Lyndon McIntyre, you know, kind of a famous broadcaster with the CBC, he once said, I'm just keenly aware that for every one person who comes up to me and says they like my work, there are 10 people who probably are like, oh, that guy. So there is that. But I would say in some ways journalism has gotten harder. There are entire ecosystems designed to prevent us from digging and getting to the truth. There are extreme limits to our availability or our ability to access information. There are deadline pressures, like constant deadline pressures, because now we're not really working towards the 6 o'clock newscast or the print deadline of 9 p.m. or whatever, because things can go up all the time. I think it's up to us to resist those pressures as much as we can. Because people lose faith in journalism when it's not right. So it's, you know, be first, yes, work hard, work harder than everybody else, but make sure you're getting it right. And there are also tools now that, you know, I can't imagine doing this job without Google Maps, right? So it's like, you gotta just kind of accept where you're at in the grand scheme of what journalism has always been and kind of keep those core principles of just pushing and pushing.
When you look at the depth of journalists and the number of competitors you have and the time people have, you know, I'm concerned that we don't have the ability for deep investigative journalism anymore. And there's lots of people who would love that, including politicians. But when you lose that depth and ability to take the time to research things and not be bound by irrational schedules, and perhaps at least in your vein that you're in, you might have that luxury, but I don't know if journalism as a broad career still allows for that sober second review. I mean, there's a review process, but boy, there's pressure just to jam out content to keep eyeballs and clickbait, maybe to some extent, keep people's attention. That's so, not to put words in your mouth, that's a layman's observation of how things have changed over 10-year, even a 2-year period, because people's attention is so short. And the, you know, the resource depth, I think, is shrinking through layoffs and compression and challenged business models. You know, how does journalism survive in this environment and still fulfill the intent and purpose that it needs to in society?
Yeah, I think you're right about some large strokes are correct. I think that there is a need and an appetite for investigative journalism. I should say I also worked at the Fifth Estate, and I also worked for the Atlantic Investigative Unit for a time. So this is something that's very close to my heart.
Okay.
I did a few investigations in Montreal too, and it's extremely expensive, right? Because on one hand, you have a daily filer who's filing every day. On the other hand, you have one person who's ostensibly paid roughly the same who files once a month, right? So what's your better return on investment? Yeah. I can't tell you, calculate it. But I guess my message of hope would be that no matter how things change, what platforms, how people consume news, is it on YouTube, is it, you know, on TikTok, whatever, the thing that drives, and like this is publicly available information, the thing that drives people to find out stuff is new information that they couldn't get any other way, which is investigative journalism. And, you know, I think it's up to newsrooms. And I'm privileged to be at the CBC. Like, I'm aware, obviously, it's a publicly funded model, that has more space for that sort of thing than if you were at like a local radio station, for example, where you're doing like, you know, basically writing entire newscasts by yourself. So I'm aware of that. But I think it needs to be prioritized as best it can. And I know that there are pushes to get more of that, and it's coming from the very pragmatic place of needing
economics.
People will read it if you publish it, and it's groundbreaking in some way. People are not always reading things that are reprints of news releases, you know. But again, certainly the economics of journalism, not something I know super well, but I can say that. The systems that are in place to prevent us, you know, like Ontario is really working to make drastic shifts to its freedom of information, scheme. I've filed ATIPs, or they're not called ATIPs on PEI. I forget what they're called, but the access to, what are they called on PEI?
FOIP request?
And gotten extreme pushback. Gotten messages being like, oh, you have to pay hundreds of dollars. What?
Yes, that's become more obstructive, I think, by intention. But it's expensive to dig out the information and have the Freedom of Information officers managing it. But it does restrict the ability for not just journalists, but for the public to get information.
Well, that's it. I mean, why have the law if you're going to make it impossible to or very expensive to access? So, you know, these are all things that we have to work through. I don't have any magic solution for that. It's hard. It's hard work. It's something that journalists have to prioritize. But I do think that there's often payoff when you invest in a story.
Yeah. Well, and I wasn't looking to challenge. This is an observation. I've done pretty rudimentary publications in our local newspaper, for a number of years, and I see the industry changing. And I see the pressures that people are under and the compression of the workforce. It's a really challenging vocation, I think, today for people to pursue journalism. I know some young people that are pursuing it. And I question the long-term sort of, it's essential, but what is the viability when we're getting news pumped at us from outside our borders? We're consuming information through social media, which may or may not be vetted or accurate, so that the entire the integrity that's required for journalism, I think, is under a little bit of assault. Anyway,
no, if I can even bop in on that, I'll speak for my colleagues who have who are in the private, on the private side of things, and talk about the meta ban. You know, the you can't post news articles on Instagram or Facebook because of a dispute between Meta and the federal government. And you know, that hurts them, right? Even with money that they then get from, I believe, the government, for that. But it's, you know, these things, these are systemic, they're challenging. And you're right. You got to fill a newspaper or a newscast or whatever. You have fewer people. It's harder. There's just no getting around it. That's just the truth of it. But people have been telling me since I got into journalism that there's no future in journalism, and I'm still here.
Very good. And now you're a senior reporter, so.
Because everybody else has been laid off. Just joking. Just joking.
What about, you mentioned on the, did they relax that, and I forget the name of, there's a bill that was passed maybe under Trudeau. Did Carney change that? And are the, so Google, Meta, they're not sort of providing?
I believe they're providing one of them is, Google is paying subsidies, I believe. But I think it's $6 billion, which is being dispersed. But Meta, they're at an impasse. I'm not sure if we've heard from the Prime Minister if he plans on changing that.
Okay. It's a pretty, and we won't dwell on it, it's a very, strong force to come up against some of these, you know, tech companies. They're powerful. And I know small, journalists, like a very successful local newsprint is, Paul McNeil in his papers that he does in Eastern Graphic and West. It's a big problem, and he's been an advocate against the imposition of these you know, gigantic tech companies, but we'll see where that goes, I guess. One question I have just on the changing of the perception of the changes in journalism. You know, you're a successful young woman, still young by my measure. But there's lots of new and unrewarding aspects from, you know, political interference and online criticisms and even hostility. How do you confront that, rationalize it, stay focused, and maintain your commitment to journalism integrity in that kind of a pressure environment?
It's a really good question, and it's a question a lot of my colleagues and I have talked about. Certainly, some of the people in my space, some of the more high profile people, more high profile than me, get a lot of hate and abuse online, and that's very challenging because, you know, at the end of the day, everybody's a person. You're still logging on and getting walls of anger, or sometimes, you know, what appear to be sort of campaigns targeting you based on the work that you've done that day. And I don't know of any journalist who goes into work in the morning, at least, you know, in the CBC context, and says, oh, I'm going to make today really hard for such and such political party or whatever. Like, nobody, most people I know are coming into work and trying their best to tell the best story that they can. Yeah, exactly. I have some personal strategies, like if I post on X Twitter, I just automatically mute notifications, so I never never see anything. I don't have it on my phone. I don't have it on my. I make it difficult for that to get to me. Like I don't read 90% of it, but I would say that I compared to some other people, maybe because I'm not very active in public spaces on social media. I used to be, but I don't anymore because I, again, don't see any return on investment in that. Like, you're not getting positive feedback. You're not, or it's not even that you need positive feedback, but you're not building connections there anymore. You're just getting yelled at or hated or whatever. So there's no, at least for me, it also doesn't seem to get my journalism seen by more people. So I just don't really get why you would do that. So I'm just not really very much in those spaces anymore, and that's really limited the amount of
vitriol that comes your way.
You know, criticism. I'm open to criticism. If you email me and you say, hey, I saw this piece, I really didn't like how you did that, and you just like tell me, I'm reading that, I'm thinking, I'll respond to you. I'll be like, hey, thank you, I didn't see it that way or whatever. I'm open to that. I think we have to be, you know, as journalists, like, We hold the powerful to account, but we also have to be aware that we yield or we wield some power ourselves, right? Sure. So you have to be, it has to be a relationship of accountability with the audience. But if it does appear to be some sort of like hate campaign where you're getting like 70 emails of just telling you you're the worst, then I don't really.
It's not productive. The one thing that people lose sight of is the humanity to this. So, not to pick on you, but any journalist is providing a service. They're doing a job to the best of their ability, or they wouldn't be there. Presumably that, there'd be natural selection and the people would find another path. But, you know, there's a loose perspective that, you know, there's anonymity sometimes of people who can hide and conceal their identity. You still are a person that connects to the community. In some cases, journalists have families and they still want to go to the grocery store. And if you're in a high profile, position, as you might be in a smaller market like PEI, really difficult to separate that work function from, you know, attending your children's soccer game and how that can affect, you know, your community engagement and relationship. And, again, not to sort of put perspectives in your, for you, but I see a change. I see a change in people's temperament, attention span, frustration levels, and I don't know what has precipitated, whether it's a COVID overhang or it's just the freedom of being able to rapidly make a post and then retract from it. But the impact of some of those posts lasts much longer than the, you know, 30 seconds it takes to snap something off. So I don't know if you're seeing a change amongst your colleagues and what people would say, but as a casual observation, I see that, and I think it's difficult environment sometimes.
I agree with you. I don't want to sound too Pollyanna-ish because I know some of the abuse that some colleagues have gotten is well beyond any sort of rational acting person harassing them or whatnot. But I will say that I do agree with you that polarization is a problem that appears to be growing. I don't know if things are stabilizing or what kind of where people are at right now. But I will say that, I told you I am the Conservative Party beat reporter for CBC in Ottawa. And of course, you know, they ran on a platform of defunding the CBC. So I would be at a lot of Conservative events and you're always upfront about who you are at sure. wherever you go, right?
We've got a microphone with your logo on it. Well, I've got friends of mine that work at CBC, and that was a real bone of concern, I think, that policy decision.
That's up to the public to decide, but I would be who I am, and somebody would come up and say, oh, defund the CBC, and then I would try to have a conversation with them, you know, and just see what motivated that perspective and just try to talk to them and understand it better. And then, you know, sometimes it worked out that they had their perspective and we heard each other and we had a face-to-face conversation, and probably that person still wanted to defund the CBC when they walked away. And it's not up to me to convince them otherwise, right? Like, that's a public policy perspective and they're entitled to that view, and for sure. But at least we had a human-to-human conversation, and some of those actually, that happened a number of times over last year's election campaign, and I found all of those conversations to be very worthwhile. So,
well, let's not dwell on that. That's enough negative perspective of journalism. We will come back to your senior parliamentary reporter sort of focus area, because I think that's pretty cool and it's relevant. But let's talk about specific stories. And you're a reporter on PEI. Maybe just on reflection, are there certain stories, whether they're national from the Western, for the Northern territories you're in, from your home province, what are some stories that kind of resonate with you and that you feel you kind of made an impact?
Oh, I love that question. I hate that the first thing I thought of, and this wasn't even my story, was once there was a fox living in a crow's nest at UPEI.
Okay. Only PEI. That's a story that you could only get. High profile PEI.
Okay. No, look, I've been blessed to be involved in a number of stories that were impactful or meaningful. Kind of a fun one I did. Fun depends on your perspective, I guess. But what year was it? It was before. It was when Stephen Harper, Trudeau was the prime minister, and I was living in Montreal. Through a little bit of research, I realized the person running against him, who had been nominated by the Conservative Party, was actually a performance artist. He had pretended to be a conservative in a very ridiculous way for years, and the Conservatives just didn't care. They needed a candidate in Papineau. Which was not a riding they were likely to win. This candidate would pose with giant checks for like jets and stuff, which was very much in the zeitgeist at the time. And they somehow still allowed him in. And, you know, we did a story on it and he was removed, obviously. I did a lot of work in the sexual assault space after Me Too. I did a lot, specifically at Concordia University, kind of hearing those stories, and specifically in the English faculty, we did a number of stories on perhaps some not appropriate behavior that was happening there. I did two documentaries with the Fifth Estate on We Charity. Recall the charity that was part of a spending. Some might say scandal here in Ottawa, but yes, we kind of looked into where they were spending their international donations. So we did a couple on that. What else have I done? You know, it's been a great career. It's
been a great career here. I've focused on a number of areas, including I did a number of things on the MOU between Alberta and the federal government last year. That's still kind of for a potential new pipeline to the west. That's a very interesting continuing story. Obviously plays into the war. Well, it doesn't play into, but it's something that would affect all Canadians because, as you know, cost of gas is quite high and, you know, we're looking for more export markets in the face of these tariff threats and these actual tariffs put in place by the United States. What else have I worked on? I've done a number of, I've been very lucky, but it's, you know, what have you done in your career? It's hard to pick just a couple.
Yeah, well, you know, a couple that you've mentioned, I think the, it's too bad that Tragically Hip didn't hear about this story on PEI because a fox in the,
I know, right?
It's like in the crow's nest. It's much more compelling than just being in a hen house. So how did that work out okay for the crow in the end?
Well, the crow had vacated, I guess. And so the fox just moved right into the nest. It was, you could just walk up the tree. There, if you Google it, it's still very findable on the, UPEI. There was another story I did when I was up in, Iqaluit about this community. And of course, that's up past the tree line, right? So there are no trees after a certain, point. And, this one community every year for Christmas would bring in one tree and they would light it up and then the power went out. So I did like a story. I know it was, they like blew their power grid because they were trying to light this tree. And that was kind of a, but it ended up being a nice story because the community all came together and, you know, they lit the tree later and it was like a special thing. So
is there any of those stories, Kate, that you kind of have followed, post production just to see how things worked out, you know, the We Charities or is there anything that you, there's a postscript to that might not be commonly known outside of what was reported? So you probably get a personal connection. I'm sure you track some of these things over time or they resonate with you as a, you know, as a part of you when you produce them.
For sure. Especially the big ones, like the ones that I worked on at the Fifth Estate or with the investigative unit. Another one, I looked into the, pervasive allegations of, drink spiking in, Charlottetown. I did a couple fairly major stories on that that I think led to some policy change, led to different legislative committee hearings and discussions about kind of how the rules need to shift in order to better facilitate, both policing and, prevention in that space. So that's obviously very meaningful when stories that you work on lead to,
positive outcomes. Yeah,
exactly. What other ones? Well, certainly, yeah, the Concordia stuff I did at Concordia with my colleague Steve Rukavina, and there were a few of us involved, led to actual policy outcomes as well. And that is quite meaningful. Fox in the crow's nest, though, I think they let him just stay there.
Yeah, well, if he can get up that tree to the nest, he deserves to stay there. Let's talk a little bit more about your, how long have you been a senior parliamentary reporter? And how long have you been covering specifically the Conservative Party?
Sure. Yeah, so almost exactly 3 years ago I got here. So it hasn't been that long. I just kind of, I didn't walk in and say I want to cover the Tories. Like that it's the beats kind of.
They come available and you can try to.
Yeah.
That's a senior role too.
Yeah, it just kind of worked out that in our bureau in particular, somebody who had been doing that role got elevated to a host position, Catherine Cullen, and she's fabulous and she still is a great reporter and she's on air in a reporting capacity pretty regularly too, but, there was kind of a vacant hole. I was happy to be in that space. My dad's a Tory. It's not a secret. So it's not like I had never been in those spaces before. I took it on. I enjoy covering that party. It's an interesting party. Still in many ways, it's still in its infancies in many ways, like the modern version of the party, the merging of the
PCs and the alliance, you know, they've only elected one prime minister so far, right? Yes. And so there are all of these ongoing questions like, well, what does it take to actually win? What does it take to, where do we sit ideologically? How do we keep the big tent together without splintering part of it to groups like the PPC, remember the Maxime Bernier party, and but still keep the coalition big enough to win? And I find that very interesting.
And the country is so vast that you get different perspectives of right of center ideology from one coast to the other. And I think that's one of the things that the party's trying to reconcile presently. Just a question, as a journalist traveling the last election campaign, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Pierre Poilievre did not allow journalists to travel in his plane. It was more of a family space, I think. So how did you cover, you know, the leader of the opposition, I guess, at that time through the campaign period? And would you have to make your own travel arrangements to get to events?
Yeah, that's basically how it worked. Yeah, we went through private travel and we did our best. So, you know, we missed some rallies, we missed some events. So the way it worked for me personally was I covered the first and last week with the Conservatives, and then I had 1 week with the Liberals, which happened to be the week of the debate. So everybody's in Montreal because they're all doing debate prep, that sort of thing. The first and last weeks are obviously like the big pushes. I guess we just did our best. I'm sure the party, well, I know the party from talking to sources I know that the party is aware that they missed some opportunities, through not having media travel with them. However, I'm sure the party is also aware that maybe they're not unhappy about how the media, basically their control of the media, right, and their ability to limit access to things. So they made a choice that had trade-offs, and we'll see what the next election brings.
So I think we talked a little bit about sort of Pierre Poilievre, and in the last, I don't know, 10 days, I've listened to two podcasts that he was involved with. One with Joe Rogan, the other one was with the Diary of a CEO, I think, podcast. They're long. I listened to them. And the one thing that I was struck with was there was a much more human element to Pierre Poilievre than I would have appreciated or been awakened to during political cycle. As a journalist, do you get to see a personal side of politicians, or is everything so scripted and controlled and tight that you just get the talking head that you're going to see on a soundbite, and that's kind of as much as people get exposure to it with any politician, not unique just to the to Pierre Poilievre or the Conservatives? How do you get to know somebody that you're trying to report, you know, on or for or with?
It's an interesting question. So I came here in 2023, right? And Pierre Poilievre would have won the leadership in 2022. And when I arrived, they had this like massive lead, right? Like this 20-point
yes.
lead that carried through till January.
January. Yeah.
I think that their strategy, reflected that lead. I think that a lot of the, you know, sometimes when politicians are well in advance and there's an election looming, there's not a lot of impetus to
say less. The less you say, the better, maybe.
Just say what you need to say, and then right. And then if you've already, you don't need to put yourself in potentially high risk situations like going on Joe Rogan where you cannot control the questions, and potentially making some sort of gaffe or whatever. And so to answer your question, no. What I've seen of Poilievre is the same as what you've seen of Poilievre. I'm in a literal physical place where I can talk to his advisors and that sort of thing.
But no, I don't
have any sort of, like personal connection to him.
No. And is that the same with most journalists? Is the reporting limited to the press corps and the kind of the questions you can thrust at somebody to try to understand better where they're coming from. Like, there's not really an opportunity to get to know the individual. I think the reason I ask this in these podcasts, and this is probably by purpose, again, much more humanity seemed to come out. And he talked about, you know, his autistic daughter and the impacts of that. I mean, there's just a whole other personal element to what he has conveyed in the podcast than what we would have seen as the aspirant prime minister a few months ago.
Yeah. And I think that they were both powerful podcasts, where he, not just the personal, he talks about his family a lot. He talked about his motivations, kind of his personal philosophies. He also talked about, like, you know, he was able to show off, I don't think it's controversial to say he's got a great brain for history, right? Like, he was able to wrap in a number of references to philosophers and in a way that you don't get on Parliament Hill in a, you know, Axe the Tax news conference.
Right.
Which is typically the space I'm in. But I will say that these are choices that he's made, right? Like, last year, for instance, he was not going on Joe Rogan. He was asked to go on Joe Rogan. He said no. He said in that podcast it's because he didn't want to leave Canada, but he is, or during the election, but he is choosing now to do these longer sit down interviews with, international outlets, not Canadian outlets.
Right.
So, you know, there's always, as you know, like, there's always strategy in the decisions that are made. Certainly in Ottawa, the response to the Rogan podcast in particular was pretty much across the board. You know, that was a success. He didn't step on any landmines and he presented Canada's interests quite well.
Yeah, very well. Sure. Yeah. And he supported the prime minister, which was not something that I would have expected an opposition leader to be so unified in dealing with these existential considerations that we're grappling with. Kate, maybe you and I can have a podcast. You can use a worldwide headquarters here as a backdrop and you can get any politicians on.
I'll get to sit down and talk to him about Marcus Aurelius, his favorite.
You've got an hour, 90 minutes, whatever you want.
That's good.
Here's a question, if you're okay. A lot of the things you've covered, I would say very much fundamentally support rights of women that may be otherwise not reported, at least maybe not so much by male journalists. And you've got experience as an author as well. And the subject matter, which at the time was probably quite controversial, you've done some other reporting on issues, not just drink spiking, but other things that are very pertinent and personal to women's rights. Anything you want to share on that subject or maybe the context of the book that you've published, which I think has been successful?
Sure. Thank you. I wrote a book now about 8 years ago about abortion on PEI, which of course was a very live issue at the time. Before I was a journalist, I was going through kind of like a legitimate, but I was learning about the world and learning about where I wanted my space in it to be. Me and five friends, started a group to fight for access to abortion on PEI. This is in part what my book is about. We kind of helped launch that movement that later, of course, resulted in, access to abortion being repatriated to PEI. Of course, it was banned, right, essentially, for 30 years after it was made available in most other parts of Canada, not New Brunswick, but that's another story, or there were restrictions in New Brunswick. I started that before I was a journalist or before I kind of committed to being a nonpartisan, a different role in society. Was transitioning into being a journalist as other amazing women and men brought the actual project over the finish line. So I sort of started the book in a memoir space because I was part of it and then tried to focus the attention on people like Colleen McQuarrie and others who were able to both work with and against the PEI government to sort of force their hand into making abortion available on PEI. So that was hugely rewarding to write about, and to kind of, now there have been a couple books, I think, not just mine, but to
put into a sort of history type book and get that story out. And you know what? I still sell some copies of the book, but mostly it's taught in universities, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. Because then I get to talk to the students who had no idea that this was a thing on PEI. And as I've told you, PEI is very close to my heart. I try to go back as much as I can. During the pandemic was considering, like so many others, moving back permanently. It means a lot to me to have written that book and met all of the people. And you know what, Wade McLaughlin, I'll give him props. He gave me an interview for the book just about his perspective, because of course it was his government. I mean, their hand was essentially forced. They were being sued. but they did open up a women's center that provides a series of services to women across the fertility spectrum. I think they also do IVF and things like that. So that seemed like a very elegant outcome. I can't speak to how well it's working now. I don't know, but at the time, that's how it appeared to be.
You know, writing a book is a very, a significant accomplishment. It's great. And the fact that it's being taught in universities is wonderful. It's a really big commitment to author and publish a book, but especially on something that, in 10 years ago is not long ago, but we have changed a lot in 10-year increments. Very controversial subject at the time. And, you certainly seem to have had a hand in propelling us, I would suggest forward. Others listening may feel differently, but I think these are important things for women's rights. Change the subject to something you mentioned, your connection to PEI. And as an islander who's, not patriated back to the island at the present time, when you look back at the island today, what do you see? What's your perspective? What are things that are going really well, and what are some things that really probably could be improved as you look through a lens from another, environment?
It's interesting. So I want to frame this in the context that I love to dip into the news on PEI. I'm a regular news consumer of PEI, but I'm not as plugged in as I used to be. So please, if I'm factually wrong about stuff, please be gentle on me. But one thing, it seems like there has been a lot of growth. I've been gone for I came back briefly during the pandemic, but just to erase that doesn't count. So I've been gone really for almost, I guess, let's just say 13 years. And there's I remember being a kid, I never had actual Mexican food until I was in my 20s. So no shade to Pat and Willie's, but now there are the diversity has really kind of lifted the island in an interesting and wonderful way. That's one takeaway. But the growth, the building, everywhere I go, my dad lives in Morrell. There's a big, there's a whole bunch of stuff going up in Morrell, which is crazy. Like, it's crazy to witness. It's nice. But I don't know what can improve. It's the same classic thing, right? Ever since we were kids, it's hard to move back. It's hard to move back for economic reasons. And I don't want to share too much, but my partner and I have talked about just the theory of moving back. Both of our jobs are very Ottawa centric, and we love our Ottawa centric life, but what would it take kind of thing? And it's hard to answer that question.
What about an offer from the Exchange podcast? Is that enough to really tilt the scales? Because as you can see, I mean, we have a spot here for you.
Well, the other thing for me specifically is, if I were to stay as a journalist, it was very hard because my mom's the police commissioner. My dad worked at BAC. My family's big in potatoes. It's just there were just too many conflicts of interest. It was very hard to operate in that space.
That's okay. You can't swing a dead cat without getting a conflict in PEI. There's a lot of proximity to connections, not a lot of separation. You mentioned 13 years, so the population's grown about 30,000 people in the time since you've left. So that does take a strain on infrastructure. It also gives the benefits of diversity of the culture, but also food, cuisine, lots changed in a short time. I always found, I lived in Halifax for 10 years, and coming back, it was often like a soap opera. You could go away for a year and come back and very little changed. I think in the last 13 years, as you reference, just because of the diversity and the growth and the development, every community has changed a little bit.
Mm. That's right. I actually feel in some ways PEI was ahead of the curve on the immigration issue because there was such a wonderful influx of new Canadians coming to PEI in a way that, you know, really, I think, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, helped the economic situation, but also introduced a whole bunch of wonderful things into the island ecosystem. But then we also started hearing about strains on schools and hospitals not because of their immigrants, but because of the large influx of population, right? And then we started seeing that in other parts of Canada as well.
I think it's a myopia of public policy. I mean, I think not just immigration, but a lot of these taxation, everything's like a pendulum. It always goes too far one way before you realize it's got to swing back. And I think in the case of this public policy, maybe it went a little bit too far. And I think it's not even that it went too far, because there have been economic projections on our population growing to 200,000, 400,000. So it's achievable with the right infrastructure and the right commitment and planning. And I think the absent part of, you know, growth is planning. And I think that's where the government failed. That's where infrastructure development didn't keep pace with growth. You know, just not to dwell too much on this, but Canada has for the first time acknowledged a decline in population. And as somebody who's interested in business and economics, that's not a good thing. So I think what'll happen, there'll be a policy to reconcile that, which will swing too far and cause other problems. But we can't have a declining productive economy and population, the number one driver, unless we all turn to robotics and artificial intelligence and agentic. We need people to be productive. So yeah, it's an interesting conundrum. And I think, unfortunately, back to the myopia of politicians, they look in a 2-year increment, federal and provincial. And, you know, China's got a 100-year plan. Maybe that's something when you're covering some of these politicians. How do we get beyond the myopia of a 2-year election cycle? Can we get to a 10-year plan? Because I think then you could provision the right infrastructure and the groundwork and the planning and the investment to ensure viability and long-term structural improvement, which often we don't have. Anyway, that's my commentary. So,
no, and if I could even just add, sometimes I talk to people in the federal immigration space who say, well, we are, you know, Pierre Poilievre says that the consensus on immigration is under threat or broken. Canada has welcomed immigrants for its basically entire existence, but now people are speaking out against this. And federal, like, government sources that I talk to say, well, you should be looking at the provinces and the municipalities, because they were begging for more people and then they didn't allocate more schools or a sufficient number of schools. So there is a bit of a blame game being played on a governmental level. But we'll see how it all shakes out, and we'll see if maybe this leads to when more shifts are made to the immigration policy to allow more people in. You know, the government seems to be trying to rein it back right now. Whether or not this spurs changes on a provincial and municipal level to make sure that there are adequate services to accommodate people who are living where they are.
You know, I think at the municipal level, even at the provincial level, governments can plan if they're giving information on which to make plans. It's the same that business can make decisions if they've got information. The absence of information, bad things can occur. You know, they've caught up, I think, at PEI, at least they've built some schools to accommodate the growth, but the growth has stopped. And I think the biggest place you're going to see that, and you see it in Toronto today, is the change in the accommodation sector. Condos are under duress. They're not being completed. People are losing a lot of money on investments that they've made with the expectation things would continue. Interest rates would probably go up now because of the inflationary impact of the war in the Gulf. So all of these things, I think we have a construction, a bit of a bubble in PEI. So from going from people needing more capacity, now we've got an overcapacity. And I think we'll see the same impact in PEI as we've seen in Toronto, where buildings are incomplete, they're unfilled, and people lose their buildings, unfortunately. But that's a consequence of not having good information on which to make structural plans.
Good point. That's a good point. I was talking to my partner's friend, who is a developer in the Atlantic space, who said that PEI is actually been pretty consistent, but it's been the changes to the schemes and the changes to the different housing programs that are just creating challenges for him. That's just one person's perspective, but I can see what you're saying would have a bigger impact.
Well, you're the journal. I'm just observing a small little micro community. Kate, we've had a great conversation. We've probably chatted for about an hour or so. And I don't want to keep you too long, but is there anything else that you'd like to comment on or reference back to PEI and, you know, from your roots where you came? Someday I hope you do return, and it sounds like it's at least, you know, top of mind to consider at some stage. But what are your observations? What are your comments? People who want to enter journalism, you've been probably, I would say probably one of a handful of the most successful journalists that PEI has produced. I can think of a couple others that we won't reference, but and you don't need to be referenced in their sort of vein. But you know, you've really accomplished a lot. And I'm sure there's people in the journalism programs, both at Holland College and PEI, that would look to you for inspiration. What do you say to those students, and what do you say to fellow Islanders who are, you know, looking at what's happening in Ottawa, wondering how we maintain a place in the Federation? I think that should be a concern based on some of the things I'm seeing, including our debt burdens. But, yeah, what are your perspectives to young people and old people like me?
Well, first, thank you for having me on your Excellence podcast. I love seeing new shows in the PEI media, you know, media scape. So that is excellent. Congratulations on a great show. To journalism students, I would say just, like, keep going. Just, like, people are going to tell you there's no future. There is a future. For as long as people have lived, they've wanted stories about what's going on around them. And that's always going to be true. Keep kicking whoever needs to be kicked at, whatever. If you've got that spotty sense, just keep following it. Doesn't always lead to big scoops, but sometimes it does. And it's important to have a mechanism to hold people accountable. And you know, there are fewer and fewer, it feels. And finally, also journalism is an actual space where you can make a difference. Like, you, one person, can go and make a real difference to systems, which is a very powerful tool to have, and not something that should be treated lightly. And to Islanders, I mean, you're just the best people in the world. I miss it very much. I think that it's an exciting time in Island history. And I would say, don't be afraid to go. Oh, this sounds very patronizing. So I mean this, like, when I was an Islander and I left the island, I was like, I don't know anything. I'm from PEI. And then I just learned that that's not true. You know, you're on equal footing as everybody else. And, you actually bring a lot to the table because you know how to operate. You know how to, exist in places where you have to cooperate, and you have to work together to get things done. And that's a tool that, not everybody, has or is born with. So I just keep on being a great place to be.
Thank you very much for your time. And I think, like every Islander who leaves PEI or breaks free, whatever the terminology would be, the key is elasticity. And how do we encourage people with the experiences that they've gained? Like in your case, how do we bring those experiences and that knowledge back? And I think that's how PEI prospers and gets better. But I really want to thank you, Kate, senior parliamentary reporter with CBC, former Islander, and now, as many people before you have accomplished the height of your career by being on the Exchange podcast. And this, you won't get a plaque, but you will know that it's one accomplishment that you can talk to others about and feel rewarded. So listen, thank you so much for being here today and taking of your time to share your perspectives with Islanders. I hope we get a follow-up story on that fox, see how he's doing, if he's had a litter up in the trees. Maybe they learned to fly.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed my time, and I'll keep listening to this excellent podcast.
We'll get you a link to the Island Do, islanddo.com, where you can find all our podcasts. And thanks again for your time.